The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Rachel Freed. I'm one of the librarians out at a West Philadelphia branch near St. Joe's University called Winfield. It is absolutely my pleasure tonight to introduce Wesley Stace and David Levithan. Before we get started with a super quick introduction, I want to remind everyone to please turn off your cell phones. Also, no flash photography and no video. There'll be a podcast up on our website later. You can check it out. You can hear yourselves laughing. It'll be good. Really quickly, I'm going to introduce our second author first. I'm sure, as you know, under the name John Wesley Harding, novelist, singer, songwriter Wesley Stace has released 15 albums in genres ranging to folk and pop music. He's performed with performers like Roseanne Cash, Bruce Springsteen. He's had music in motion pictures like High Fidelity. This is his third novel, Charles Jessold Considered a Murderer. It is a thriller set in the world of English classical music in the early years of the 20th century. There's intrigue, there are plot twists, but most of all, there is truth because it's based on a true story, which is creepy. Now, my personal favorite and a person who I've absolutely adored since I first read Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist and could not put it down and read it straight through without eating or using the bathroom or sleeping for several hours. David Levithan is the author of, obviously, several highly acclaimed young adult novels, Will Grayson, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, Dash and Lily's Book of Dares. In his first novel for adults, The Lover's Dictionary, he tells the story of a modern romance in the style of short dictionary entries, progressing alphabetically through words in an episodic narrative. If I could really quickly, my personal favorite one, which I'm sure you've all read, Kerfuffle, noun. From now on, you are only allowed one drink at any of my office parties, preferably a beer. Exacerbate. I believe your exact words were, you're getting too emotional. And finally, yearning, noun and adjective. At the core of this desire is the belief that everything can be perfect. So, ladies and gentlemen, my very first of my favorite young adult authors, David Levithan.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I immediately had to move the post-it from Kerfuffle. I was like, oh, she read Kerfuffle. You gave away the ending. Now that they know Kerfuffle, it's like, I guess that's true. Thank you all for coming. I hear it was a long Tuesday for most people, so I'm glad they're here and not at the bar. So Lover's Dictionary is my first book about what I like to call post-teenagers. Grown-ups would probably be a misnomer because I don't know that there is such a state, and if there is such a state, I don't know that the characters in this book have actually reached it. It is the story of a relationship told in dictionary form, hence the title, The Lover's Dictionary. It was written as a Valentine's story for my friends. It's a tradition I've had since I was in 11th grade, which was 23 years ago. And every Valentine's Day since then, I've written a story for my friends. This one was born on February 1st of 2 years ago. As you can see, I'm not very good at preparing and deadlines. So February 1st arose. I had not written a word. I knew all of my friends were expecting a story in their inboxes. And luckily, I had the New York Times Book of Words You Need to Know that had been given to me as a graduation present, either as high school graduation, eighth grade graduation, college, I don't know. I'm sure when I received it, I smiled, I said thank you, I threw it on a shelf. But my parents were cleaning out their basement, and I retrieved it and thought, oh, this is interesting. And so what I thought would be interesting, I'd collaborated with many other authors before, but I'd never actually collaborated with a book before. And so I thought, why don't I choose words from this book in alphabetical order, one word per page spread, and try to tell the story of this relationship? And I just sat down, and 2 weekends later, I had the first draft of what this book would end up being. So yeah, so what I'm going to do very easily. It's great because it's a nonlinear narrative, which means I can read whatever the hell I want, and it will make just as much sense as anything else. So as you'll see, I'm just going to skip through the alphabet. This is the last event I'm doing for this book, so I've chosen sort of my greatest hits, except, of course, for Kerfuffle. No, you read it better than I could. All right, so we will start with the first, but we will not end with the last. I should look at my watch. Okay. Aberrant, adjective. I don't normally do this kind of thing, you said. Neither do I assured you. Later it turned out we had both met people online before, and we had both slept with people on first dates before, and we had both found ourselves falling too fast before. But we comforted ourselves with what we really meant to say, which was, I don't normally feel so good about what I'm doing. Measure the hope of that moment, that feeling. Everything else will be measured against it. Antsy, adjective. I swore I would never take you to the opera again. Brash, adjective. I want you to spend the night, you said. And it was definitely your phrasing that ensured it. If you had said, let's have sex, or let's go to my place, or even, I really want you, I'm not sure we would have gone quite as far as we did. But I loved the notion that the night was mine to spend, and I immediately decided to spend it on you. Contiguous, adjective. I felt silly for even mentioning it, but once I did, I knew I had to explain. When I was a kid, I said, I had this puzzle with all 50 states on it. You know, the kind where you have to fit them all together. And one day I got it in my head that California and Nevada were in love. I told my mom, and she had no idea what I was talking about, so I ran and got those two pieces and showed it to her. California and Nevada, completely in love. So a lot of the time when we're like this, my ankles against the backs of your ankles, my knees fitting into the backs of your knees, my thighs on the backs of your legs, my stomach against your back, my chin folding into your neck, I can't help but think about California and Nevada and how we're a lot like them. If someone were drawing us from above as a map, that's what we'd look like. That's how we are. For a moment, you were quiet, and then you nestled in and whispered, contiguous. And I knew you understood. Dissonance, noun. Nights when I need to sleep and you can't. Days when I want to talk and you won't. Hours when every noise you make interferes with my silence. Weeks when there is a buzzing in the air and we pretend we don't hear it. Elegy, noun. Your grandfather dies a few months after we move in together. There is no question that I will go with you, but there are plenty of questions when we get to the funeral. I know you haven't slept. I know you've spent the night on the computer trying to pin down what you feel. I know why you didn't accept my offer to help, just as you know why I felt I had to offer help anyway. On the car ride down, you practice what you're going to say. You use the word confliction when you really should just say conflict, and you use the word remarkability, which I'm not sure is even a word, but I don't say a thing. I just listen to you say them over and over again because they are what you need to say. Then we get there, and the first words out of your mother's mouth are, nobody's speaking. That, more than anything else, throws you off, makes it seem like you've been bequeathed a bad patch of gravity. I'm bombarded from all sides. Most people don't know my name, and nobody knows what to call me in relation to you. Something more than a boyfriend, something less than a spouse. I met your grandfather once, and he was nice to me. That's what I can contribute. That I met your grandfather once, and that he was nice to me. Something happens to us that day. It's there during the service when you don't let go of my hand. It's there back at your mother's house when we retreat to your childhood bedroom and go through your old chest of drawers, where we find stale jelly beans and notes from high school you hadn't wanted your mother to unearth. It's there when your mother bursts into tears after most of the guests have gone, and I don't need you to say a word to know I am not to leave the room until you're leaving it with me. We have fallen through the surface of want and are deep in the trenches of need. That night, driving home, I ask you to tell me stories about your grandfather. And as we travel farther and farther from your mother's house and closer to our own apartment, you unspool the memories and turn them into words. From behind the wheel, I learn the difference between a eulogy and an elegy and discover which is more vital in life and in death. Fast, verb and adjective. Starvation and speed, verb and adjective. This is where I get caught. A fast is the opposite of desire. It is the negation of desire. It is what I feel after we fight. The speed does us in. We act rashly. We say too much. We don't let all the synapses connect before we do the thing we shouldn't do. You make it a production, slam doors, knock things over, scream, but I just leave. Even if I'm still standing there, I leave. I am refusing you. I am denying you. I am an adjective that is quickly turning into a noun. Healthy adjective. There are times when I'm alone that I think, this is it. This is actually the natural state. All I need are my thoughts and my small acts of creation and my ability to go or do whatever I want to go or do. I am myself, and that is the point. Pairing is a social construction. It is by no means necessary for everyone to do it. Maybe I'm better like this. Maybe I could live my life in my own world and then simply leave it when it's time to go. Imperceptible, adjective. We stopped counting our relationship in dates, first date, second date, fifth date, seventh, and started counting it in months. That might have been the first true commitment, the shift in terminology. We never talked about it, but we were at a party and someone asked how long we'd been together, and when you said a month and a half, I knew we had gotten there. Juxtaposition, noun. It scares me how hard it is to remember life before you. I can't even make the comparisons anymore because my memories of that time have all the depth of a photograph. It seems foolish to play games of better and worse. It's simply a matter of is and is no longer. Lover, noun. Oh, how I hated this word. So pretentious, like it was always being translated from the French. The tint and taint of illicit, illegitimate affections. Dictionary meaning, a person having a love affair. Impermanent, unfamilial, inextricably linked to sex. I have never wanted a lover. In order to have a lover, I must go back to the root of the word. For I have never wanted a lover, but I've always wanted to love and to be loved. There is no word for the recipient of the love. There is only a word for the giver. There is the assumption that lovers come in pairs. When I say, be my lover, I don't mean, let's have an affair. I don't mean, sleep with me. I don't mean, be my secret. I want us to go back down to that root. I want you to be the one who loves me. I want to be the one who loves you. Meander, verb. Because when it all comes down to it, there's no such thing as a two-hit wonder, so it's better just to have that one song that everyone knows instead of diluting it with a follow-up that only half succeeds. I mean, who really cares what Soft Cell's next single was as long as we have Tainted Love? I stop. You're still listening. Wait, I say, what was I talking about? How did we get to Tainted Love? Let's see, you say. I believe we started roughly at the Democratic gains in the South, then jumped back to the election of 1948, dipping briefly into Northern constructions of the South, vis-a-vis Steel Magnolias, Birth of the Nation, Johnny Cash, and Fried Green Tomatoes, which landed you on To Kill a Mockingbird and how it is both Southern and universal, which, correct me if I'm wrong, got us to Harper Lee and her lack of a follow-up novel intersected with the theory, probably wrong, that Truman Capote wrote the novel, then hopping over to literary one-hit wonders and using musical one-hit wonders to make a point about their special place in our culture, I think. Thank you, I say. That's wonderful. Sometimes this is the only kind of following that I need. Misgivings, noun. Last night I got up the courage to ask you if you regretted us. There are things I miss, you said, but if I didn't have you, I'd miss more. Nomenclature, noun. You got up to stretch, and I said, hey, you're in Ivan's way. You looked at the TV and said, that's Tina Fey. I tried to keep a straight face when I explained, no, the TV's name is Ivan. The TV has a name. Yes, and you're never going to guess what it is. Does everything have a name? The answer was no, only Ivan, because when I bought it with Joanna, I promised her I would call it Ivan. But I didn't tell you that. Instead, I told you I'd named everything. You pointed to the couch. Olga, I said. The refrigerator, Calvin. The kitchen table, Selena. The bed, Otis, I said. The bed is named Otis. You pointed to the light fixture over our head. Come on, I said. Who names a light fixture? Non sequitur. Noun, this is what it sounds like when doves cry. Posterity, noun. I try not to think about us growing old together, mostly because I try not to think about growing old at all. Both things, the years passing, the years together, are too enormous to contemplate. But one morning I gave in. You were asleep, and I imagined you older and older, your hair graying, your skin folded and creased, your breath catching. And I thought, if this continues, if this goes on, then when I die, your memories of me will be my greatest accomplishment. Your memories will be my most lasting impression. Recant, verb. I want to take back at least half of the I love yous because I didn't mean them as much as the other ones. I want to take back the book of artsy photos I gave you because you didn't get it and said it was hipster trash. I want to take back what I said about you being an emotional zombie. I want to take back the time I called you honey in front of your sister and you looked like I had just shown her pictures of us having sex. I want to take back the wine glass I broke when I was mad because it was a nice wine glass and the argument would have ended anyway. I want to take back the time we had sex in a rent-a-car, not because I feel bad about the people who got the car after us, but because it was massively uncomfortable. I want to take back the trust I had while you were away in Austin. I want to take back the time I said you were a genius because I was being sarcastic and I should have just said you'd hurt my feelings. I want to take back the secrets I told you so I can decide now whether to tell them to you again. I want to take back the piece of me that lies in you to see if I truly miss it. I want to take back at least half the I love yous because it feels safer that way. Suffuse, verb. I don't like it when you use my shampoo because then your hair smells like me, not you. Sorry. transient, adjective. In school, the year was the marker. Fifth grade, senior year of high school, sophomore year of college. Then after, the jobs were the marker. That office, this desk. But now that school is over and I've been working at the same place in the same office at the same desk for longer than I can truly believe, I realize you have become the marker. This is your era. And it's only if it goes on and on that I will have to look for other ways to identify the time. Ubiquitous, adjective. When it's going well, the fact of it is everywhere. It's there in the song that shuffles into your ears. It's there in the book you're reading. It's there on the shelves of the store as you reach for a towel and forget about the towel. It's there as you open the door, as you stare off on the subway. It's what you're looking at. You wear it on the inside of your hat. It lines your pockets. It's the temperature. The hitch, of course, is that when it's going badly, it's in all the same places. Unabashedly, adverb. We were walking home late from a bar, and the term walking is used loosely here because you were doing something between a skip and a stumble. And suddenly you started singing out your love for me, my name and everything, loud enough to reach the top floors of all the buildings. I should have told you to stop, but I didn't want you to stop. I didn't mind if your love for me woke people up. I didn't mind if it somehow sneaked into their sleep. You grabbed my hand and twirled me around, two sidewalk sweethearts. Then, very earnestly, you stopped, leaned over, and whispered, "You know, I'd get a tattoo with your name on it, only I want you to have the freedom to change your name if you want to." I thanked you, and you resumed your song. Wayne, verb. The year before our first anniversary, I thought, I can't do this anymore. I was shopping with Joanna, shopping for you, and suddenly I couldn't stay in the store. She asked me what was wrong, and I told her I had to end it. She was surprised and asked me why I thought so. I told her it wasn't a thought, more a feeling, like I couldn't breathe and knew I had to get some air. It was a survival instinct, I told her. She said it was time for dinner. Then she sat me down and told me not to worry. She said moments like this were like waking up in the middle of the night. You're scared, you're disoriented, and you're completely convinced you're right. But then you stay awake a little longer, and you realize things aren't as fearful as they seem. "You're breathing," she said. We sat there. I breathed. Yarn, noun. Maybe language is kind, giving us these double meanings. Maybe it's trying to teach us a lesson, that we can always be two things at once. Knit me a sweater out of your best stories. Not the day's petty injustices, not the glimmer of a 7/8 forgotten moment from your past, not something that somebody said to somebody who then told it to you. No, I want a yarn. Doesn't have to be true. "Okay," you say. "Do you want to know how I met you?" I nod. It was on the carousel. You were on the pink horse. I was on the yellow. You were two horses ahead of me, and from the moment you got in the saddle, I wanted to drop right next to you and say hello. Around and around we went, and I kept waiting for my horse to pull ahead. I sensed it would know when I was ready, and I was waiting for that moment. You rose and you fell, and I followed, and I followed. I thought my chance would never come. But then, like magic, all the power in the entire city went out at once. It was darkness, utter darkness. The music stopped, and there were only heartbeats to be heard. Heartbeats. I couldn't see you and worried that you'd left. But right at that moment, the moon came out from behind the clouds, and there you were. I stepped off my horse just as you stepped off yours. I turned right, and you turned left. We met in the middle. And what did you say? Don't you remember? I said, what a lovely evening this is. And you said, I was just thinking the same thing. As long as we can conjure, who needs anything else? As long as we can agree on the magical lie and be happy, what more is there to ask for? I loved you from that moment on, I say. I loved you from that moment on. You agree? Finally, yesterday, noun. You called to ask me when I was coming home, and when I reminded you that I wasn't coming home, you sounded so disappointed that I decided to come home. Thank you.
Hi. It's very nice to see you tonight. Thanks for coming. The book begins with a newspaper report that a composer, Charles Jessold, has murdered his wife and her lover and then killed himself on the premiere of his big opera, Little Musgrave, which never gets to be put on. The novel is narrated by the critic, Leslie Shepherd, who is Jessold's friend. The opera, Little Musgrave, is based on a folk song, and this is the story of them finding it for the first time, and then I'll sing the song. Jessold refused the map. I have no sense of direction whatsoever, least of all now. The only time I know where my arrow points on the compass is when I'm on a train to or from London, and sometimes not even then. It was fortunate that I had planned the excursion in advance, because in my diminished state, I did not have the mental acuity or inspiration required to blaze a trail. This brought us, indecently early, to a farm where lived a Dan Mossop. He and his wife were surprised to see the two of us with our knapsacks and notebooks, but most welcoming. From my sack, as if from a hat, I summoned a rabbit, one of two purchased from our gardener. The Mossop woman's eyes lit up as she set about transforming that evening's meal into a potato and rabbit pie, while Mossop explained that he could only spare us an hour, for he expected company. This grizzled man, with furrows etched deep in his face, had the infuriating habit of mouthing everything said to him slightly after you'd spoken, but when he sang, he was a wonder. His wife pottered about, noisily dicing onion and carrot, occasionally cooing over the rabbit, as though it were being repeatedly presented, then begging its pardon before unceremoniously skinning it and throwing it into the pot. She joined in unpredictably with her husband singing, always in unison. Jessold, his blend of tobacco mingling with the sweet smells of cookery and waste in the kitchen, barely looked up as he wrote. I'd leave all that finicky notation to him if he was so keen on it. Mossop lost himself in singing and would, I believe, have sung all day. It took a staccato bang on the door to bring him to his senses. What's the time? He asked his wife. Then with wide eyes, oh, Lord. In strode a soldierly man with shooting stick, briefcase and toothbrush moustache, not the type of company one might have predicted for the Mossops. And we were evidently the last people he expected to see. When this intruder revealed an unwieldy phonographic recording device, the ticklishness of the situation was plain. I could guess this man's name without difficulty. My nemesis from the letters pages. Banter. What have we here, Mossop? It was as though he was still on the parade ground. His voice, his demeanor, all suited the author of that offensive letter. Mossop, his song gone, looked anxiously at me, as if to say, I know my place. You ought to be the one to explain. My name is Leslie Shepherd. This is my friend Charles Jessold, the composer. Shepherd, Banter said, bristling. My name was the final straw. I really wasn't in the mood for fisticuffs. Apart from the fact that I never was in the mood for fisticuffs, I hadn't slept. On top of that, I'd just been rudely awakened from a trance induced by Mossop's keen tenor. Further, I did not deserve the ire of a local bigwig who felt he had the right to something that was, by definition, common property. Shepherd, he repeated, rocking on his heels. There was an impasse that I did not have the wit at that moment to resolve. Mossop came to our rescue. Gentleman bought us a rabbit, Mr. Banter. A rabbit. He's bought you a rabbit. His tone was one of resignation. The old ways are gone, it said. All the future holds is bribery, corruption, and rabbits. Jessel stood, peeved at the introduction, his teeth gritted insolently round a pipe. Out of respect for the Mossops and their humble home, he pointed to the door, where he stood in front of Banter, addressing him in level tone without looking at him. Sir, we have not been properly introduced, yet you treat us as though we are intruders. In fact, Mr. Mossop opened the door to us of his own free will. You are the one who walked in without so much as a by your leave. And then out of the blue, he faced Banter eye to eye and asked a good deal more aggressively, what do you say to that? His behaviour was baffling. He'd gone through none of the recognisable stages of brewing anger. He now positioned himself so Banter had little choice but to square up, and I had a horror that there was to be an actual fight there and then in the Mossop hovel. I should perhaps have been worried about the prospect of my guest losing this bout, yet I cared only to leave swiftly while we still held the moral high ground. The air of incipient violence had at all costs to be diffused, yet I could plead only to Jessold. Carlo, I whispered, hoping this tone might placate him. I placed a hand on his arm, feeling the minute flexings in his forearm, and the moment passed. Banter twitched, stood at ease, and started anew, clearing his throat. My name is Daniel Banter. I have an appointment here with Mr. Mossop at 10 o'clock. It is now that time and then some. It seems that by unforeseeable coincidence we have beaten you here. The early bird catches the worm, they do say, said Mrs. Mossop, inhaling the aroma of the simmering rabbit. She meant the remark to soothe. Or vice versa, growled Banter. My grip on Jessel's arm tightened. Banter was in the wrong. But that didn't bother the man. He deserved a thick lip for that remark alone, but my only worry was smuggling Jessold out before he dealt him one. I hurried our goodbyes, sacrificing the Mossops to Banter's asperity as the bouquet of our slow-cooking bribe sweetened the room. After such a bright beginning, but then a cruelly truncated morning's work, the afternoon session started badly. Our mood turned black with the sky, and we had to shelter in a copse until the downpour had wrung itself out. One edge of my map became mâché where the rain had pummeled it. Possible destination seemed implausibly far in the current climate. Glimpsing blue sky, we pedalled off with hope in our hearts, only to be welcomed by another biblical torrent that hounded us from the road. An unexpected, fortunately brief assault of hailstones, the size of sovereigns, left us no choice but to shelter in a ramshackle barn that offered as little cover as an interior could. To our surprise, we found a shepherd also there, wet through, shivering in his white smock as his dog towelled itself on any available hay. The shepherd seemed somewhat abashed, as though our presence had shifted ownership of the space. I can't imagine we looked any more dignified than he, but we did own bikes, and Jessel was wearing a cricket cap that perhaps made us seem like two-thirds of the men in a boat. The rain drummed on the roof, and we thought it best to invite the shepherd into conversation, lest acute social anxiety caused him to withdraw and perish. In his peasant cap with his boundlessly energetic dog, he was a figure from Bruegel, lacking only a tray of pies or a kerchiefed apple-cheeked wife. He had a soothing voice made for lullaby, and his speech bubbled with unnecessary diphthongs and slaloming elisions. His name was Harold Marsh, but most of the locals called him Romney, for that was where he grazed his sheep. All of the locals grazed their sheep there, he said with a chuckle, but only he and his father had the surname Marsh. My reflex was to ask if he sang. We were still on the clock, after all, however much of a washout the day proved. Yes, he answered. His father was a regular songbird. We'd be pleased for him to give us a song, I said, and he agreed. Jessold and I settled ourselves on a dry bay while the sheepdog played catch with the rain. Marsh removed his cap out of deference not to us, but to the song that he was going to sing. This formality, as though the singer were taking the stage at the Albert Hall, was always deeply affecting. I shall give you, as it fell out upon a day, the ballot of little Musgrave and Lady Barnard. What he gave us then was one of the most beautiful things I had ever heard. I must somehow convey how moved we were, both by the song and its performance, and yet I suppose the progress of this sad story will convey that only too well. We knew that we had stumbled upon something quite extraordinary, quite unknown in English musical circles. Little Musgrave has always been preeminent amongst the ancient ballads. By 1611, in Beaumont and Fletcher's The Night of the Burning Pestle, it is already proverbial. And some they whistled, and some they sang, hey down, down, and some did loudly say, ever as the Lord Barnet's horn blew, away, Musgrave, away. To scholars, the ballad is known simply as Child 81, after its numerical designation in Francis James Child's monumental collection. The basic story has the tragic pull typical of the big ballad. The Lord is hunting. His lady seduces a young man. A page runs to alert the Lord, who returns to confront the lovers in bed. He slays them both. That is all. Most ballads cut to the chase. We often seem to join them in the fifth act of the drama, but in Musgrave, we are granted the full tragedy on an epic scale. Variants allow surface change, including many different names for the protagonist, but the outcome is the same. The lovers are doomed. In one version, the men are brothers. In another, Musgrave is married. In one story, they bribe the page. In another, an ally at the hunt tries to warn the lovers by blowing his horn. The deep matter remains unscathed. He is seduced. They are killed. Balanced against this universal tragic inevitability are the specific personal details that give the ballad its supernatural power. A ring, a smile, a bridge, a hawk, an honest page that cannot be bribed. It was not only Marsh's telling of the story that amazed, it was the miracle of the tune, previously unknown to me. I assumed Jessel was familiar with it. This was the only way, knowing his stern views on such matter, that I could account for his lack of notation. I was quite wrong. He was so entranced that he forgot to write, forgot even to recharge his pipe. Every now and then, Marsh picked out a verse for particular emphasis. This he sang with a different melody entirely, as though these were choruses separate from the rest of the ballad. The specific verses were neither randomly nor numerically determined. Rather, they were chosen because of their heightened drama. After Lady Barnard's murder, the second melody became something even more wonderful and unpredictable for the climax. Marsh hadn't lost his way, nor was he improvising. He, or his ancestor, had deemed the typical repetitive melodic structure of folk song too simple to support the weight of his tale. I had never heard anything like it. I was transported. Time stood still. The rain seemed to stop drumming. Even the dog lay quiet on the ground. This version, which incorporated so many of the others, prolonged the inevitable conclusion, dwelling on it rather than having done. And thus it also froze the moment as we watched and listened. At his end, Marsh calmly sang the first verse again. The tragedy was doomed to play itself out eternally. Jessold's eyes swam with tears. He gave the little shudder that accompanies unexpected emotion, strode towards Marsh, and clasping him warmly by the arm, shook his hand in congratulations. Now I will break my cardinal rule, Mr. Romney Marsh, and have you sing it again. If you'd like some moment to recover, fine, but you shall sing it again. In fact, you'll sing it twice for us. Joseph Addison's great words on ballads came to mind. I must only caution the reader not to let the simplicity of style prejudice him against the greatness of thought. Where do you live, Marsh? I asked. The rain had stopped at last. Perhaps we were an obstacle to his duties. Yonder in the cottages outside Stone, you'll find me easy. You have sung us something most beautiful, said Jessel. Can we hope that there are more? Nothing so grand, sir. Only what my father taught me. I sings them to the children. They're always asleep by the murders. Thank you. Mm-hmm. not quite what they heard, or indeed anything like it. But it is the version I know of the song. My version is, the version in the book is something of a fantasy. See if you can hear this. As it fell out upon a day, as many in the year, Musgrave to the church did go to see fair ladies there. Some came down in red velvet and some came down in pall, but the last to come down was the lady Barnard, the fairest of them all. She's cast a look at little Musgrave, as bright as the summer sun. Then bethought this little Musgrave, this lady's a love I've won. Good day, you handsome youth, God make you safe and free. What would you give this dame Musgrave to lie one night with me? Well, I dare not for my land, lady, I dare not for my life. For the ring on your white finger shows you are Lord Barnard's wife. Lord Barnard's to the hunting gone, I hope he never returns. You shall slip into his bed to keep his lady warm. There's nothing for to fear, Musgrave, you nothing have to fear. We'll set a page outside the gate to watch till morning's here. And a woe be to that little foot page, and an ill death may he die. He's away to the green, green wood as fast as he could fly. When he came to the white water, he fell on his belly and swam. When he came to the other side, he took to his heels and he ran. When he came to the green, green wood, 'twas as dark can be. And he found Lord Barnard and his men asleep beneath a tree. Rise up, master, he said, rise up and speak to me. Well, your wife's in bed with a little Musgrave, rise up right speedily. Well, if this be true, you tell to me, then gold shall be your fee. But if this be false, you tell to me, then hanged you shall be. Go saddle me the black, he said, go saddle me the grey. And sound you not the horn, he said, lest our coming it would betray. Now there was a man in Lord Barnard's train who loved little Musgrave, and he blew his horn so loud and shrill, away Musgrave, away. I think I hear the morning cock, I think I hear the jay, I think I hear Lord of Barnard's horn, away Musgrave, away. Lie still, little Musgrave, keep me from the cold. It's nothing but a shepherd's boy driving his flock to the fold. Is not your hawk upon its perch, your steed is eaten hay. And you a gay lady in your arms, and yet you would away. So he's turned him right and round about, then he fell fast asleep. When he awoke, Lord of Barnard's men were standing at his feet. Well, how do you like my bed, Musgrave? How do you like my sheets? And how do you like my lady fair that lies in your arms asleep? Well, it's well I like your bed, he said, it's well I like your sheets. Better I like your fair lady that lies in my arms asleep. Well, get up! Get up, Lord Barnard cried, get up as swift as you can. For it never will be said in my country that I slew an unarmed man. I have two swords in one scabbard, full dear they cost my purse. And you shall have the best of them, and I shall have the worst.
And so slowly he got up, slowly he put on, slowly down the stairs he goes, a-thinking to be slain. The first stroke that Musgrave took, it was both deep and sore. Down he fell at Barnard's feet, word he never spoke more. Well, how do you like his cheek, lady? Yeah, how do you like his chin? And how do you like his fair body? Now there's no life within. Well, it's well I like his cheek, she said, it's well I like his chin. Better I like his fair body than all your kith and kin. And he's taken up a long, long sword to strike a mortal blow. And through the lady's heart, the cold steel it did go. It fell out upon a day as many in the year, Musgrave to the church did go. To see fair ladies there.
Thank you very much.
Why bother talking now? Well, I have a feeling some of you have questions, so if you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. And please wait for the mic. Who would like to start us off?
We could just sit here awkwardly for a while. Stare at you. Come on. Usually
we've
guilt
said
words.
It all.
We've covered it. You've noticed how much there is in common between our books. Clearly, we can just talk about it.
I'll take
but
the blame for
that. There was a hand over there. If you're, thank you.
When I hear you speaking and you say the word wrong, I hear the song in my head, I'm wrong about everything. How do you feel about being often quoted in families?
How do I what?
You're quoted often, you know, in fights and in families. I'm wrong about everything, you know. How do you feel?
I think
like
that phrase might have been there before I was there. Or maybe not. I don't know. I wouldn't have thought that I was. And I feel as bad about it as I do but about the person who told me that they got married to Here Comes the Groom, which was about as wretched a song about marriage as you can possibly imagine. And the thought of that coming down as two people walk down the aisle is so horrific to me. I've never been asked that question, and I have no idea how to. I feel very awkward about it. It's a compliment, right. Then thank you.
Continue. Who's got their hand up? Oh, all the way in back, sorry.
Hi, this one is for David. I know you tend to play a lot with narrative structure in your books, and I'm wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about that, especially given the fact that the one that you just read from really plays a lot with that.
Sure. I mean, I think part of it is trying to never write the same book twice and trying to figure out different ways to play around with that. I mean, I always joke that it's sort of the cruel fate of the writer that just when you discover what your voice is, you immediately want to stop using it and find other voices. And I think that was true with me. Like, I wrote Boy Meets Boy, which, again, wasn't my voice, but it was a voice that I felt very comfortable writing in. And then for my second book, I was like, oh, I have to do a novel in verse from 20 different voices as a way of just getting away from that voice and doing something different. And then the next book after that was in third person. And so I'm always trying to vary it up both story-wise and content-wise, but also in the narrative approach. And sometimes the narrative approach dictates the story. Lover's Dictionary, again, I came up with the sort of rubric for writing it. I was like, oh, I'm going to do this as dictionary entries before I had any idea who the lovers were, what the story was, how it was going to work. I was just like, I started with aberration and just went forward and discovered the story by writing it. Other times, though, I will think about the story and be like, oh, what is the best way to tell this? Is it a back-and-forth narrative? Is it straight narrative? Do I want to write it in verse? Do I want to write it fragmented? Is it linear? Is it not linear? And the story will dictate how it's told. So that's why I try to keep changing it up. The book I have coming out in September, Every You, Every Me, was really fascinating to me because it was another collaboration, this time with a photographer named Jonathan Farmer, who's a friend of mine. And he gave me photos one at a time, randomly, and I wrote the novel based on the photos he was giving me. He had no idea the whole time what I was writing. He literally did not read the book until I was finished with it. And that was fascinating because that in itself should have dictated some of the structure, but actually the character has an incredibly broken structure of telling the story. There are lots of crossouts in the book and a narrative that's very unreliable. And that I didn't know until I got into the head of this kid. And then suddenly that and the photographs complemented each other, but it wasn't something I knew I was going to be having photographs in the book, but I had no idea what the narrative was going to be like until I was there. I hope that answers the question.
Wes, can you feel that one a bit too, talking about narrative structure and how you're incorporating song and things of that nature?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I totally agree. And, you know, there are those kind of books where you just feel that the structure has totally defeated the characters in the book. You know, when kind of that kind of hard-edged postmodernism, which can be very enjoyable in its own right, but when it kind of takes over, and with me it's just all in service of the characters, and so the first book is kind of starts in the third person and then ends up being in the first person for a very specific reason, and then the second book's mostly narrated by a ventriloquist dummy, and you know, but there's reasons where if it was just a trick you wouldn't use it, but if it explains the characters then I think it's all worthwhile. It's just that life is complicated now, and you can't have a Dickens-y guy or a Fielding-y guy narrating a novel. It doesn't make sense in the 21st century. It's ridiculous. Life is more complicated than having some all-knowing character who rules everything. But then, on the other hand, just provided the characters are allowed to do what they want.
Mm-hmm. More hands? Fourth row there. Fifth row. Would you wait for the mic, please? Marzouk, could you get her the mic, lady in the white?
Yes, I wanted to talk about the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, when you're talking about the different voices, did you feel for that they were different voices you had inside of you that you wanted to tell the story, or did you outline out, these are the people I want in this book? And I also wanted to know, the character of Jamie is the sort of androgyny, lack of gender identification, very intentional. And what do you feel you achieve from that?
Sure. I mean, for those of you not familiar with Realm of Possibility, is my second book, because I love the phrase, can we talk about the realm of possibility? Sure. it wasn't quite as deep a question as it sounded.
Sorry.
No. Because I've been in conversations with that where I'm like, oh, and in the realm of possibility, people are like, wow, he's talking about science. I'm like, oh, no, that's a book I wrote, sorry. But no, that one, it was as many of my novels, it was not meant to be a novel. I had an assignment for an anthology to write a story about guys. That's a vague topic. And I remembered in high school, I did not smoke cigarettes except with my best friend. And for some reason, that the idea of smoking with just one person, I was like, oh, that's interesting. And so I just started writing the first line, and I've been working on a lot of poetry as an editor, and suddenly, like, I hit return, and there was a line break. And I was like, oh, wow, this has just gotten much more interesting here. let me see if I'm writing in verse. And so I wrote the first story, Smoking, and I decided that I would do it like the play La Ronde, which I don't speak French, I'm butchering that, I'm sure. Or as we say in Jersey, La Ronde. but I wanted one story and then a minor character in that story to be the lead character in the next, which ultimately I didn't do because that was too constraining. So instead I was like, oh, well, let me just try to plot all of these intersections. And I actually wrote the first 10 stories just writing them. And some of them were connected, some of them weren't. I didn't know how they were connected yet. And then the only plotting I did for the book was on the PATH train, so another Jersey thing. I sat down with a notebook. I was like, okay, you need to divide these into sections, and you need to actually figure out who is intersecting with who. And that, literally, it's a page with the names, and that was about it. Some of the voices just came to me. I mean, I was like, oh, okay, Korean grocer's daughter, let's do it. Others appeared, again, as secondary characters in the stories, and I was like, oh, that person sounds interesting. I mean, I just did this author festival in New York, and one of the panels, somebody said, your secondary characters always have to have lives outside the book. You have to believe that they have interesting things to tell as well, or else it's going to be very flat, and I try to write that way. And so this was great because I got to run wild with that. I was like, oh, this person has life. Let's go see what that looks like. Jamie's deliberately androgynous, just as the lover in the Lover's Dictionary is deliberately androgynous. I just felt that it was interesting to see a character who you don't know the gender and see what that matters and if it doesn't matter. And that has frustrated readers ever since.
Is that a choice also to make the book appeal to a wider audience? Does it have that sort of economic undertone, or is it really...
Yeah. No, I mean, it was really, with Lover's Dictionary, it was interesting because as I was rewriting it, I realized that I wasn't, in my mind, committing to one or the other, and I thought, well, isn't it much more of a challenge to have a character who could be both? Mm-hmm. And because I feel, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about it to me is for the milieu that they're living in, that a 20-something couple in New York right now, that there isn't much of a difference. That if they were gay, they wouldn't be struggling with their sexuality. That wouldn't be an issue. They'd just be two people. If they were a heterosexual couple, it wouldn't be an issue. So it was really interesting for me to be able to write the characters, and because of the situation they were in, gender actually doesn't matter. And so that was deliberate. It wasn't economic so much as I liked the idea, and believe me, the reviews have proven this in spades, that the reader could map out their own relationship onto it, whatever that relationship was. And that's been the case. That the reviews have been about 7/8 saying that it's a woman, about 1/8 saying it's a guy. So it's pretty much in line with, I'm sure, the
same. And is it breaking out according to the gender of the reviewer?
Oftentimes, yes.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. But that, again, that it was more a creative challenge and an interesting trying to make the reader fill in blanks than it was any other reason.
Mm-hmm. Shall we keep going? A few more hands? Yeah, a fellow all the way back about 10 rows.
Thank you. This one is for Wes. I hadn't realized until tonight that this was a book that was based on a true story. I was wondering how you happened upon this tale and why it appealed to you.
Well, it's to say it's based on a true story is not really right, but it is in as much as this. I saw a Werner Herzog documentary called Death for Five Voices, which told the story of a Renaissance madrigal composer called Carlo Gesualdo, who's spectacular for two reasons. One is that he murdered his wife and lover in Naples and got away with it. In fact, he didn't get away with it. Because there was nothing to get away with, because she was committing adultery, it was his right to kill her. So he got out of Naples, because he did at least have that much common sense, and bizarrely, he laid this very clever trap for them where he pretended to go out hunting and changed the locks on the door, and it was a very complicated plan. So then he goes back to Gesualdo, he's a prince, which is handy, and he goes back to his town that's named after him, and he cut, as if his life couldn't get any more Shakespearean, he cuts down the trees in 7 miles in every direction of his hilltop so he can see them coming for him. And they never came for him because he was too powerful. But what in popular thought this did
this murdering thing was free its artistic soul to write atonal music 350 years before it was invented by the rest of the world. And he wrote crazy madrigals with tritones and incredibly difficult-sounding music that was not rediscovered until it was rediscovered by Stravinsky at the beginning of the 20th century. That in itself was fascinating. So I then read this biography of Stravinsky, and which was all about how, a lot of it was about how codependent he was on and with his own critics, writing to scandalize them so they'd write more about him. It's, and then I suddenly thought, oh, that's great. So I don't really want to, I want to write about a modern composer, not an, you know, this Renaissance composer. And then I wanted to make, so that much of it's, that bit's true, but my composer is not true. Nothing about him's true. Nothing set in the 20th century is true at all. I have to tread very carefully here because there are mysterious elements to the book. But, I mean, the book is set up that he committed a copycat crime and that his name is quite similar. And either that is just weird or there's more going on. And so that was my inspiration for the book. The book is called Charles Jessel, Considered as a Murderer, because what criticism does is it writes a persuasive essay. And if that persuades enough people, then that becomes the fact. But it's only a nice narrative that makes sense of available material. And in fact, the key moment when writing the book was to realize, I don't want to go into the music history of it too much, but in England there was this musical renaissance, as there was in many nations, where they discovered folk songs, brought them up, made them classical music, because in 1910 in England, it was all Strauss, Wagner, Mendelssohn and Handel, which is very bad, because we were just about to be at war with Germany. And our royal family at that point was called the Saxe-Coburgs, which doesn't look good, so they changed it to Windsor. Right? And the most popular dog was the German Shepherd, which is not called the German Shepherd in England anymore. It's called the Alsatian since 1910. So they changed, they rebranded everything German and made it English. And this movement, which you just heard that bit set in, is part of that world. And Jessel moves from the world of this rather parochial world of pro-English traditional folk music, classical music, and he moves towards atonal music. And once I began to think of him as a Bob Dylan kind of character who ditches folk music for a wider world of expression, to the great chagrin of those critics, and my critic is the narrator of the book, and he's definitely somebody would have booed Dylan at Newport. So, I mean, there's as much truth, really, so the original truth is back there somewhere, but it was really just a very slim inspiration, although I massively recommend that Herzog documentary, Death for Five Voices, which, like most of his documentaries, is slightly more fictional than his fiction movies, in fact. But it's a very beautiful movie that was very inspirational to me, and was certainly like I saw that movie and went, I'm writing a novel about that, but I don't know what I'm going to write about it.
Check it out.
And if you listen closely when we when you came in, we were playing some of the Gesualdo music.
Gesualdo?
We were playing the madrigals, yeah.
Well, some of the Gesualdo is sicker than other bits, but it's very beautiful music.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I couldn't tell that it was sick. Another question or two? Yeah, right here in the front row.
This is for David. I've noticed that you use a lot of music in your books, like whether putting lyrics or talking about songs. Does that come into play when you're writing a book? Like if you're listening to a song and you think it should be included as a part of a passage, or do you fully intend to use a song to write something? Like are you inspired by songs? How to say it?
I mean, I don't think there's a direct correlation between the music that appears in the books and the music I'm listening to at the time that I'm writing. Because most of the time, the music that I'm listening to at the time that I'm writing, I'm not actually listening to, if that makes any sense. I always have to have music playing, but I can't put my favorite songs on because then I'll just be listening to them. So I think, but at the same time, I have to, I don't understand many of my writer friends who write in a monastic silence. I could never do that. I feel that I need something playing to get the words going. And so I think that, in a way, does inform, and I think that I have to pick music that fits the voice of the character. There's nothing scientific about it. It just, either it works or it doesn't. I would say one of the most embarrassing, embarrassing truths, which I will now share with everybody, is in order to get into Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist to write Nick's voice, everyone's like, oh, yeah, no, they were so, like, queercore. Were you listening to Pansy Division as you wrote it? And I was listening to Blink-182. I wanted, like, really overdramatic adolescent angst, and I was like, all right, we're just going to put Enema of the State on loop. And hopefully none of that ended up in the book. That's it. And then other times I actually, like with this book, with Every You, Every Me that's coming out, Every You, Every Me, this tangent, is interesting because that is the exception to the rule. The title is from a Placebo song, and I actually, when setting out to write the book, I was like, I want to write a character who is like a Placebo song. And so I don't even know that I listened to Placebo very much while I was writing it, but that was true. But at the same time, I also, again, wanted to fight against my voice. I realized that many of my books have musical references in it, or suddenly the characters are writing songs. I have not brought a guitar. I'm not performing any of them. That would be bad. But for this character, I didn't want that. That's not a part of his life. That's not where his head is at. And I had to make sure that there, even though that was the inspiration for the title, that was the undertone of the book, it's never mentioned. No music's ever mentioned in the books because I just didn't want to fall back on that. It's too easy.
Wes, monastic silence or madrigals?
Total. I'm not sure it's monastic, but it's definitely silence. Really? Because, well, I just can't listen to music without analyzing. I mean, I listen to a lot of music and extremely loudly, but I just can't do it when I'm doing anything but listening to it, apart from cooking and driving. Cooking and driving are maybe the two times I can listen to music. I can't have a conversation with anybody while music's playing.
Really?
It's almost impossible.
Just because you naturally focus on it?
Yeah, I mean, in a bar, you know, if there's a jukebox, right, I mean, that's fine. But, and everyone's shouting. But, I mean, if there's music on in a house, I just tend to listen to it. It can never be wallpaper for me. And I certainly have, you know, producer friends for whom it's a problem. I mean, you know, you can just see them fading away from your conversation while they consider the reverb on the snare. Yeah. You know, and it's not like that with me. It's just that I just have to listen to it. And so There is no chance of any music playing. Weirdly, though, I'm infinitely interruptible when I'm writing. Like, I love having, like, email flying in and somebody tweeting me crap. You know, I'm quite happy to be in the middle of this and then suddenly go, oh, let's deal with that. And I really like that. So it's not like I don't have a mind that can kind of, it just can't do it with music. Probably because it's my job.
Right.
I mean, you know, honestly.
Last hand, all the way in back.
I'm glad you're here tonight because I've been pondering this question for a long time in my brain, and this is a perfect place to ask. When do you know when you end a chapter and start a new one?
Very good question.
It doesn't matter who answers. I'm just like, you know, like the structure of a book. How do you know?
Andy?
Well, I usually end it. Please.
I think there has to be a natural pause. I mean, I'm by day an editor. That's my day job. And I'm constantly on my writer's cases because sometimes the chapter endings seem arbitrary. There has to be some pausing moment, whether it is reflection on the character's part, whether you want reflection on the reader's part. I think a chapter break is a form of punctuation. And it just usually there has to be an end point to sort of get you to the next chapter. Now, sometimes it's a cliffhanger ending, and then they looked in the closet. Next chapter. And sometimes it's not. Boy, he thought, my closet is dirty. It can be reflective. It could be cliffhanging. But I think, again, it has to be pretty much like a really big period that you are sort of telling the reader to pause for a moment and then going on to the next, whether to build suspense or whether because there is a natural pause of reflection or whether you're changing the scene entirely. So I think that's it. And I've tried to, I mean, one of the narrative things I've tried to do is some of my books have very standard chapter endings and very standard chapter structures. Others, like Are We There Yet?, my third novel, I really use the chapter breaks and the page breaks as punctuation. That it's really, it's like a thought is on a page and then you move to the next page.
Yeah, he's right. I mean, I think the definitive chapter ending has to be tastefully done because I just read a novel where every
chapter end was signaled so large, or did he?
Right.
You know, or, you know, right. I mean, it wasn't quite that, but it was, that was, and I was like, and it was a famous writer too, and I was just like, these really look, I mean, either he's doing it for a joke, or it's, you know, either he's doing it for a joke, or, it, you know, I think with mine, the only thing I ever get worried about is I get very freaked out if I find the section lengths don't make sense to me. Like if there's three-thirds in a book, but one's like that big. And like if I think of it in my head, that gets muddling to me, and I'd like to try and do something about this. In this book, right at the end, I just decided that the whole one whole section should not have any chapter breaks at all. And sometimes no chapter's beautiful. I mean, there's a lot of novels without any chapters at all, but just the odd gap here and there. And that can be beautiful, that one long... Like, you know, you haven't exhaled yet. That can be very beautiful, but it's very difficult to do well, I think.
And so we come to the end. Wes Dace, David Levitan. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.